Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. I am your host, Dr. J, along with Jim Nico, chief instigator of our parent company, Social Network Intermedia, LLC. Like most of us, you sometimes take a risk, perhaps with a long-term goal in view, such as building a business or a family. Occasionally short-term goals, such as enjoying a thrill, seeing if you can make an awesome play in your favorite sport, or even just making a quick move on the interstate so as not to be late for work again. Then there's the lure of fleeting pleasure, the taste of that scrumptious deli item that is clearly not on the approved list if you are going to avoid hypertension or diabetes. The pleasure centers of the brain can be stimulated by many things: food, drugs, sex. Sometimes it seems that the riskier something is, the more addictive it can become. Our guest today is Dr. Sean Young, an assistant professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, in the Department of Family Medicine. He's co-director of the Center for Digital Behavior at UCLA and a member of the Center for Behavioral and Addiction Medicine, where he is director of innovation. His academic research, teaching, and clinical work are focused on the use of social media and mobile health technologies for predicting and changing health behaviors here in the U.S. and internationally. He has spent over a decade studying the use of technologies to address issues related to HIV and drug use prevention and testing behavior in the U.S., Peru, South Africa, among Los Angeles homeless youth, African American and Latino men who have sex with men, Peruvian MSM, and American Iranian college undergraduates. Dr. Young was the primary investigator of several studies using social media, such as Facebook, to increase both HIV testing among HIV negative men having sex with men and retention in care among HIV positive men having sex with men. Results from these studies show that in comparison to a control group, peer-led social networking increased requests for home-based HIV testing by 24%. Dr. Young teaches a course at UCLA on using technologies to address global health and poverty issues. He received his PhD in psychology and an MS in health services research from Stanford University. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Young.
Thanks so much for inviting me. And if I had known you were going to be reading some of the information I sent, I would have kept it a lot shorter.
Well, you know, I understand that, but I was listening to a different show once, and the introduction to the guest was even longer than that. But boy, did it make me want to listen. I thought this, you know, so right. We have established your credentials. HIV and AIDS, that remains one of the most serious public health problems around the world. Can you tell us just how big a problem it is?
Sure. It's a really big global and domestic issue. In 2011, the statistics show that there were about 34 million people around the world who were infected with HIV and AIDS, and about 2.5 million people that were newly infected that year. Among people who are living with HIV and AIDS, it's really important that they have access to medications, to antiretroviral therapies, yet less than 25% of people around the world have access to these therapies. So that's a problem. And internationally, it's really focused among developing countries. So, for example, 70% of people with HIV reside in sub-Saharan Africa and about 5 million of them in South Africa. In the U.S., we also have a big problem with HIV/AIDS. And in the United States, it's estimated that U.S. CDC estimated about 50,000 U.S. adults over 13 were newly infected with HIV, and about 1.1 million adults, about a million, were living with HIV. In the United States, it's much more focused on men who have sex with men and on African-American and Latino populations.
When you say there's 50,000 newly infected, is that per year?
Yes, so that was within that year in 2011.
You're saying then that worldwide 3/4 of those infected are not getting any effective treatment?
That's correct. That's correct. That we need to, worldwide, there are a number of efforts that we're undertaking. So worldwide, there's the overall attempt at prevention, at preventing the spread of HIV. Another way of preventing it is to be able to help those who are currently infected by getting them treatment, and that can also help prevent the spread to uninfected individuals. So if we can increase that number, so right now, like I said, about 7 out of 10 people are not getting the medications that they need. And if we can increase that number, then we can both help to improve those who are affected by HIV, who are infected, as well as to reduce the spread to other people.
Well, I'd like to get into the connection here with the social networks. But first, I'd like to know how does the increase of AIDS cases, or maybe I should say the HIV infection rates, has that leveled off, or is it continuing to increase, say, as compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
So what we find is that you'll find overall that cases might have leveled off or decreased, except in certain populations. So what we find in the United States, for example, is that among men who have sex with men, these are men who are having sex with other men, and among this population, they are disproportionately affected by HIV, meaning that the HIV rates among this group are greater than the population of MSM. So what we find is that among MSM, men who have sex with men, and Black and Latino populations in the United States, rates have actually been increasing, especially among African-American men who have sex with men. So as HIV researchers, the real target and the real difficulty that needs to be addressed is, how do we help address HIV in these groups where it continues to increase?
Now, when you count MSM, does that include bisexual, for instance, in that African-American population? There's the expression on the down low, meaning a married man, for instance, may have an occasional encounter with another man. Are they included in those statistics?
You're right, exactly. So it's not just to say gay men, that doesn't include other men who might be bisexual or who might be married to women who are having sex with other men but don't consider themselves gay. So it's important to distinguish the difference between gay and men who have sex with men. We're broadly looking at men who have sex with men, which includes gay men. And I think it's an important point and distinction you're bringing up, because as we get into social networks, especially on the technology side, technologies allow us to reach people in a way so that they don't have to have face-to-face contact, and you can be more anonymous. And so in that sense, we can reach groups of people who want to remain, as you said, on the down low, who want to remain discreet and don't necessarily want other people to know that they're having sex with men. So that's something that we can get to later when we talk about the technologies and how they're being used.
Okay, well, let's go into that. How have you utilized social networking, such as via Facebook, to tackle these problems?
Sure. So what we do broadly in our Center for Digital Behavior, we look at how we can use social media and mobile technologies to, as you said, predict behavior and to change behavior. So the two ways that we look to do that are, one, on the prediction side, we'll look at things like Twitter or real-time social media, where we can analyze the conversations that people are having. We can analyze their tweets to be able to understand and possibly predict their future behaviors. So in cases of HIV and drug use, what we've done is looked at tweets suggesting in certain areas people might be about to engage or might have recently engaged in sexual or drug risk behaviors. And so ultimately, this can be a method of, and this is called big data, this could be a method of using big data for surveillance, for detection of outbreaks. So that's on the prediction side of something that we do.
Is that depersonalized data? I mean, do you know, we're always thinking about Big Brother, you know, and having these things identified personally, how do you deal with that?
No, that's a topic, I think, a completely different topic, but a great question. So what we've done so far is Twitter is all publicly available information. So people are putting tweets out about themselves with the knowledge and the understanding that anyone can be monitoring this, and Twitter offers this access. I think it's another question about how much do people really understand what's being done with their data, even though they're putting it out there for other people. You know, at any given time, there are many companies that are scouring through these data. And so an approach that I personally take as a public health researcher is that public health researchers need to be taking at least similar approaches in an attempt to understand people's public health behavior so that we can help them and also to help educate them about knowing what are the risks in putting their information out there. And that's especially important in areas with stigmatized populations and stigmatized diseases like HIV and with men who have sex with men or substance users, drug users, so that they know that when they're sending a tweet about something, they have awareness that this is being monitored, as you could say. I think it has the potential, you know, given that people have an understanding of what's being done with their data, we can really, from a public health perspective, we can really benefit and improve our public health system by letting people know, let's say in the case of something like influenza, if you see that people are tweeting about symptoms of influenza, you can then notify the public health departments to be able to prepare and have more vaccines ready.
That's an interesting thought. In our next segment, we'll continue talking about prevention and clinical care and treatment and how and the Facebook study. So we'll go on with that topic when we return.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This is Jim Nico with Dr. J. Listen to Lori Ruff, the voice of InfluenceRadio.net, Thursdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 Pacific, right here on the Social Network Station.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. We're talking with Dr. Sean Young from UCLA and the Center for Digital Behavior. We just got started on talking about the use of social media, and let's get into that Facebook study that you did in terms of how the public health area can utilize social networks to encourage people to take steps to improve their health or safeguard their health.
Sure. So this study that we did used Facebook, or really we set out to see, could we use social media, could we use social networking sites in general for intervening in public health related issues. So what I mean by that is there are social networks out there like Facebook, which are technologies that can reach a broad group of people. They can be scaled. So you can take community-based approaches that have already been proven in public health and in medicine, and then we can apply them online on a social network and be able to reach people all around the world rapidly. So what we wanted to do, we started within the area of HIV, because HIV, both because of the significance of the disease, as I already explained, but also because it's a stigmatized disease, meaning that people don't want other people to know that they would possibly be at risk for HIV or be infected. And so technologies, we thought, really have a strong potential role in being able to help people with stigmatized diseases, because you don't have to have that face-to-face contact. So, for example, if you're going to get an HIV test, traditionally you would go into a clinic to get an HIV test, and we've found that there's a lot of potential stigmatization associated with going in to get that test. So
sure.
You go in there and you're, you know, it might be that your doctor or the other patients in the waiting room, if they know that you're there to get the test, they might judge you as someone who already is infected with HIV. And we found that there's a lot of negative associations with being the type of person who might have been infected with HIV. So by using social networks and allowing people to, let's say, request a test from a social network, it allows them to communicate with each other without that face-to-face contact and in more of an anonymous way. And then they can even request services like an HIV test without having to go in there and be scared of the consequences of requesting those tests. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Is that a saliva type of thing, or should I not ask this question? I mean, what's involved in a home HIV test?
So there are a number of tests now that are on the market. What we did in our first run of Facebook studies, we used the FDA-approved home access HIV testing kit, which was something where you take a blood sample. It's quick and pretty painless. You take it in, and then you mail it to a testing center, and that testing center is located in the Midwest, and then you call in to get your test results.
Is that like a prick your finger in a blood spot, or does it take...
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that sounds simple enough.
Yeah. It's a simple test, and we found that in these first studies, you know, people were willing to take the test and that they understood it. And then when we did these studies in Peru, then they didn't have these home-based tests there, so we used traditional in-clinic services. And now the work that we're doing recently, about a year ago, the FDA cleared use for a new home-based test, which was made by OraSure, and this is an oral test. So you take a swab, a saliva swab, and this gets you your test results in about 20 to 40 minutes. And so we see a lot of potential for using these tests because you can increase access to testing and also, as I mentioned about the stigma, you can avoid face-to-face contact.
So let me get this straight. The blood spot, now does that have to be sent back for an analysis?
Correct. The blood spot does.
Okay. But the swab is something that you just get the results yourself, sort of like a early home pregnancy test or something.
Exactly. And it has similar, there are similar issues associated with it as people have had with pregnancy tests. So they think, you know, does having the availability of these tests, will it increase sexual risk? Will it possibly increase the number of HIV cases? They have questions about counseling. So when you typically get an HIV test, you receive pre- and post-test counseling. But what if someone tests by themselves and then they find out that they're HIV positive and then have no one to help provide the post-test counseling? So there are lots of issues on both sides.
Okay, so how was Facebook involved? Because it occurs to me that, you know, if this were all tied into a conversation on social media, that there could be at least some peer group support after the test, before the test, after the test.
You are exactly right. Yeah, before and hopefully afterward. We're actually we're studying on the after the test part of it right now. But so the approaches that we've taken were right. As a social psychologist, I'm a pretty strong believer in peer and social support to help change people's attitudes, to help change their health behaviors. And so what we did is that we started using Facebook. Now we've actually designed our own social network. But we started using Facebook and we created closed secret groups on Facebook. So meaning that no one would be able to know that you're a part of this group. You wouldn't, if you tried to search for it, you wouldn't be able to find it.
Okay.
So we created these groups and then we recruited peer leaders. And by peer leaders, we initially, in our first studies, these are called the HOPE studies for harnessing online peer education.
Okay.
So in our first HOPE study in Los Angeles, we wanted to see whether social networking technologies, in this case Facebook, could be used to increase HIV testing requests and change sexual risk behaviors among African-American and Latino men who have sex with men, because those are really the disproportionately affected groups we talked about. So what we did is that first we recruited peer leaders, so these are people who are African-American or Latino, men who have sex with men, and we trained them, we brought them into UCLA and trained them in how to use social media for reaching out and communicating to other people about the risks of risky sexual behaviors and the need to get an HIV test. These were three training sessions. And then after their training, we recruited participants. So we recruited Black and Latino MSM, men who have sex with men, to be able to be part of this study. They were then randomly assigned as in a study. They were randomly assigned to either a control group or to an intervention group.
Mm-hmm.
And in the intervention group, what we did, they were asked to join this closed secret Facebook group. And then they had the peer leaders who we had trained, and the peer leaders would attempt to reach out to them and teach them about HIV prevention, teach them about the importance of HIV testing. The participants who we recruited, they were not obligated to be part of the study. They were just told, use Facebook as you normally would. And so it was really our job to learn how do we use social media in a way to keep the participants engaged, to keep them wanting to interact with us and with the peer leaders, because they could drop off at any point if they decided to. So that was that was really our challenge, because no work had existed out there about how do you reach out to people who might not even want to be part of what you're doing, and mm-hmm. then you convince them somehow to enjoy it and want to keep engaged. So week by week, we worked with the peer leaders, and we had certain goals each week and would monitor those goals. And that was an artistic part of it, I guess you could say, in learning what's working and what's not working and really iterating on that week by week.
So you were developing some best practices there as far as online engagement. We've got a couple minutes left here. One question I wanted to ask about HIV. What is the timeline or prognosis, et cetera, from HIV positive to actually having AIDS?
That really depends. I mean, the timeline has extended. HIV can be considered now a chronic disease, meaning you can live with it. If you're uh-huh. taking your medication correctly, if you're adhering to it the way you're supposed to, it can be something where it is a chronic disease where you're living with HIV. But if you are not taking medication, and that goes back to, again, why we really need to be able to increase the amount of people who have access to medication and are taking it correctly, because that can push that timeline far down the road.
Right. And so if you have your own social network, which I imagine has lots of privacy features, do you if a listener is interested in joining that group, what would they do?
Sure. So, and we really created our own social network after talking to, so we went back and talked to some of the participants.
Uh-huh.
And what happened is my department, the Department of Family Medicine, saw the work that we had done with HIV patients and with substance use patients, and said, we want something like this for our UCLA clinics.
Mm.
So let's start. We're starting in the area of patients with mild to moderate anxiety and depression. And so I started interviewing those patients and found that they were uncomfortable. Tides have shifted a little bit, and Facebook has lost some of the enthusiasm that people had for it, and they're scared of the privacy issues. And so mm-hmm. the patients that I interviewed wanted something a little more private. They wanted something that where they'd be communicating just with other UCLA patients, because there are other social networks out there for health where they said some of the patients had joined some of them and had felt that they were being hit on by other people or didn't know mm-hmm. who they were talking to. So we created this social network as a way so that this initial cohort of UCLA patients would know that you have to be a UCLA patient to sign on. So we give them a unique code, and that it's private, and they don't have to worry about friends or family finding out that they're a part of this study, as was the case in Facebook. Some participants expressed, you know, I've heard Facebook's been hacked into.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something where we created the social network with those elements, and also with some of the elements that we found were important in changing behaviors.
At this time, it's open to certain patients at UCLA, but I want to give your internet a website address. It's SeanYoungPhD.com, and that's S-E-A-N, of course, SeanYoungPhD.com, and they can look up your research and see what else is going on, and then we'll catch up with you at another time about the Center for Digital Behavior, but the Twitter handle for that is @CDBUCLA. And it'll be interesting to follow the developments there. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Dr. Young. And this has been really hopeful and informative. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for your important work. We really respect you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice. And I look forward to following your show.
Okay, thanks.
Want to be a guest on the Social Network Show? email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This moment of uncontrollable laughter was made possible by a 32-year-old man with little to no coordination attempting to execute a simple cartwheel. His name is Sergeant Warner, but young James, our laughing friend here, simply calls him Dad. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Our guest today on the Social Network Show is Dori Clark, author of Reinventing You, Define Your Brand, Imagine Your Future. Her marketing strategy clients include Google, Fidelity, Microsoft, Yale University, Morgan Stanley, and the World Bank. She has appeared in the media, including NPR, BBC, MSNBC, and she blogs for Harvard Business Review, Owner Magazine, Forbes.com, National Center for the Middle Market, and American Express Open Forum. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dori.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Dori, thank you again. I may be your biggest fan in the world, or I'm competing to be, but we think you're just utterly brilliant, and thank you for coming back.
Oh, thank you.
Dora, you've taught us that our brand is essentially our reputation or image that others have of us. And in reading Reinventing You, which I found very, very helpful and I heartily recommend, one line caught my eye, and that was how people have wondered how could they begin to overturn entrenched perceptions that others held about them. Now, I know that's in thinking in terms of our work life and our image, our brand in a professional sense, but, you know, I thought, well, I wonder if we could apply that to young people, you know, because we've talked a lot about cyberbullying and bullying in general and empowering young people. And what could we do to apply that to young people, say mid-schoolers, who feel excluded, like everyone thinks they're jerks or their image, you know, is all wrong? You think we could swing that?
Yeah, it's a really great question and an important point. And in fact, it's interesting that you say it because over the summer when I was on my book tour for Reinventing You, I actually did give a talk to a group of high schoolers. It was kind of a fun experience because mostly I talked to business schools and corporate executives. And so I was giving a talk at out in Palo Alto at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And the woman that I was liaising with about this mentioned, she's like, by the way, I don't know if you'd be at all interested in doing this, but there's something called the Stanford Online High School, and it's, I guess, an initiative that Stanford runs, and as the name implies, it's an online high school. So these kids who attend, they kind of are quote-unquote homeschooled in that they work at home virtually, but it's a guided curriculum. Uh-huh. And it turns out that when I was there speaking at the GSB, the students had come in, and I guess over the summer they have a two-week period where they get together and hang out and get to know each other in person before they then disperse back to their homes. And so I ended up also giving a lecture to the online high school students. And, you know, I was not at all sure how my material would be received by, you know, these kids who are 20 or 30 or 40 years younger than the executives that I normally talk to. But it was actually great. It was, they thought it was apparently really interesting. I was mobbed afterwards with questions because, as you pointed out, bullying and acceptance and difference and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, your brand is what, particularly if you're a teenager, that's what you live and die by. Mm-hmm. You know, are you a jock? Are you a nerd? Are you a goth? You know, whatever it is. And people were very fascinated by the idea of being able to shape that, to take control of it, and, you know, to try to help get some insight into how to redirect other people's perceptions of them. So I think it's really spot on, and you know, I do hope that the people in all demographics, including, you know, middle and high school students, might find it valuable. I'd say that one of the biggest points that I make in the book, which I think is relevant here, is that I call it, you know, turning your weakness into your strength. And I just wrote a blog post for the Harvard Business Review about this. And that's that for so many of us, I mean, we're just lots of talented professionals, but people are very keenly aware of what their weaknesses are, you know, all too aware. And consequently, it kind of gets in your head. And when it comes to applying for jobs or presenting yourself in interviews, you constantly feel like, oh, geez, well, you know, other people are so much more such and such than I am, and I really have to compensate for that. That's a real weakness. And the point that I try to make is that you need to reframe it. And, you know, other people are not going to see it this way until you reframe it for them. But you've got to turn that weakness into a strength. And so if you are applying for a job at an insurance company and you've never done it before, you know, of course, if the frame is who has more experience working at an insurance company, you will lose every time and no one would want to hire you. But if you change the frame to, oh, okay, well, who, instead of 20 years experience at an insurance company, who has had really interesting, diverse background where they've traveled the world and done, you know, X, Y, and Z. Well, if you reframe it to who can bring a new perspective to the insurance industry, you win on that count. You kick everybody's you-know-what. And so for these kids, I think it's sort of the empowerment of not accepting other people's frames. It's about creating your own frame and making it clear that that's how other people should think about it.
Dory, recently, we had, excuse me, Nina Berlee, a Columbia professor of journalism, graduate school, and pretty famous author of one of her latest book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Amanda Knox Story. We've been following that. And one of the things that hit me, it just floored me, I think it's germane, is if you go to the website of ninaberlee.com, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H, you'll see her accolades, and I'm not saying you haven't been there or whatever, but my point is, right at the very top, she says, and I think I'm quoting it right, judge a man not by his answers, or a woman, we're saying, but by his or her questions. Voltaire. Mm-hmm. Well, that stunned me, because, I mean, it boomeranged me back to Socrates and how he always asked questions. But I think one of the most brilliant things that's happening here, real quick, is that by coming on the show the way you are now, and if people are doing their homework, from the students you allude to the executives that you help along their journey, et cetera, the fact is that if we can ask you questions, theoretically, I might get more respect for the questions I ask you in the Voltairean sense than any damn answers I may give to people. Right, Jane?
That's right.
And I think Jane's going to second that right now. Okay, and I'm going to be quiet
in my own words.
In her own words. You know. Thank you.
Okay, so may I return to the high school student or the mid-school student?
Indubitably.
I need some examples of that. Say there's, And this brings up a conundrum that really confuses me, because a lot of times after a lot of cyberbullying comes as the result of some compromising photos being sent around. And in spite of the fact that most teenage boys are crazy to get intimate with any girl, that the photos were sent possibly in trust or maybe under a bit of coercion, but then they're distributed and suddenly they're a slut. So the Unslut Project online goes into that. But can you think of any way of reframing that?
Good point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's I think that one is tougher in the sense that, you know, I come from a background working in politics. As you were mentioning earlier in my funky bio that I provided for you, mm-hmm. with all of my random things, but you know, one of them is that I was a presidential campaign spokesperson, and you know, it's absolutely true that, you know, if someone has a general view of you that is lacking from your perspective, or you believe that, you know, they're just sort of seeing you in a different or negative light, that's tough to change, but it can be changed. If there, however, is what I will call hard evidence, if there are incriminating, and you know, by which I can mean a whole range of things, photos or videos or things like that, it just becomes massively harder to correct perceptions or to change them. And you know, we think about things like Anthony Weiner. You know, if there were sort of general rumors that he was a womanizer, or you know, even if a woman came forward and said that he had been behaving in an inappropriate way, that certainly would have been damaging. But the fact that now these images are emblazoned in people's mind, that, you know, we all, if you watch the news, you've seen a picture of him in his underpants, that's really tough to get it out of your brain once it's in your brain. And so I think that really in those situations, I mean, this is where it becomes so important for teens to be educated by their parents, by schools, about the nature and the permanence of these images. I mean, you know, we have Snapchat, of course, and teens are really obsessed with that. But you've got to realize, I mean, yes, Snapchats evaporate, but if somebody's smart and they have two phones, or they have a phone and an iPad, they can take a picture of the iPhone with the iPad, and then it's not gone. I mean, you know, it's not rocket science, but we all know these teenagers' prefrontal cortexes are not fully developed, and, you know, maybe that link hasn't fully occurred to them. I mean, I came of age in the pre-internet era, or at least the, you know, pre-ubiquity mm-hmm. of the internet era. But, you know, I like to think, I was a pretty sensible kid, that, you know, I would realize that sending nude pictures of myself would probably be a bad idea. But, you know, who knows? But you've got to, I've got to say, once material like that is out there, it is really hard to get it back in the box. And I think that's an area where we have to focus on prevention.
Well, we're going to talk in the next segment a little bit about some possible remedies on that. And it also ties in well with a guest we had last week dealing with revenge porn and the possible remedies for that. But certainly realizing that anything we put out anywhere on the internet or the phone is, we need to make sure it is something we don't mind being public and permanent. But I want to run some ideas past you on how we might apply this reframe and redefining of self in that awkward situation for teenagers. So we'll take that up next.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
What could make you eager for a trip to the dentist? Well, what if it meant a trip to Las Vegas? With USC training and 18 years of experience, your Las Vegas dentist is expert in fillings, root canals, crowns, veneers, implants, and clear braces. Dr. Naheed Mohammadi's office is easy to get to from the Las Vegas Strip. Dr. Mo strives for long-lasting solutions with quality materials and superb workmanship. Find her online at NevadaSunDental.com. To schedule, just dial your country's exit code, often 00, then 1-702-898-0800. Whether you speak English, Spanish, or Farsi, you'll feel right at home, and of course, locals are welcome. 702-898-0800.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show and our discussion with Dori Clark. And we talked about the possibility of youngsters redefining themselves, especially after some unfortunate experiences, if they are perhaps the target of bullying or cyberbullying or the butt of jokes, or just generally they seem to somehow have gotten into the scapegoat role of the class, that... One thing, Dori, that I've noticed, and it may apply in corporate life too, is that a lot of negative attitudes toward people really stem from jealousy.
It's true. There is a lot of that. If people, you know, particularly if you think about, you know, the bullying of the smart kids or whatever, people are oftentimes jealous because they may not necessarily be able to perform at that level. And of course, you know, there is plenty of bullying that's motivated just from the fact that, you know, people think they can get away with it. And if somebody is in what appears to be a marginalized position where they feel like that person won't have a lot of defenders, they just go for it. I mean, it's really the sort of predatory underbelly of human nature that thankfully for most of us seems to get wiped out by the time people get a little bit older. But it can be brutal.
The civilization and the socialization is often incomplete, definitely at early ages, but even amongst adults. In fact, the French put out an interesting video that's on YouTube and other places about a scenario where a corporate executive is treated just as kids that are bullied are treated in the schoolyard at work. And it's just wonderful because it points out, you know, you wouldn't put up with this for in your place of work. How about sending your kids into that situation in school? But what I'm thinking about is what is more remarkable to me, that many of the teen suicides, the girls that are, I think we could say a majority of those cases, certainly not the only, there are boys involved too, but they're beautiful. They are very charming and so forth. And so it isn't like, you know, they're the weaklings or just, you know, the super smart kids or something like that. So I think, especially since a lot of times it's the jilted girlfriend of someone that who they sent the picture to and so forth, that just plain old jealousy in that regard plays a part. So I'm wondering, what if a person were to adopt that view as, okay, that's the reality. Well, I can't think of the phrase right now, but... you know, tough luck, you know, I'm more attractive than you are, or this is the only reason why you're calling me these names. And I'm, you know, that would take some, what kind of things do you recommend for people to reinforce their concept of their new brand? For instance, I'm not saying that every girl that's cyberbullied should promote her image as a slut. I don't mean that, but you know, I mean, in a way, using that, okay, you know, I got the guy and you didn't, you know, type of thing. But you mention in your book the possibility of having a focus group or 360 interviewing. And how could a teenager utilize that to reinforce their positive self-image?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the most important things when it comes to having the support of others is that, and I think this is particularly problematic for teenagers, is understanding the difference between friends and frenemies.
Mm-hmm.
And even you know, as adults, even at work, we have some of this. I mean, there's a couple of people in my life, you know, who have been in my life. I've kind of, you know, moved away from them. But they're people who I think kind of had frenemy tendencies. And it can be tough at first to distinguish it. But I think it would be, you know, really valuable for teenagers to develop their sense of, you know, really, really focusing on trying to find a group of friends whom they feel 100% confident, love them, and have their best interest at heart. That's, you know, that's the bottom line. And so if you are able to work on really sussing that out, you know, is this person hanging out with me because, you know, because of some motive, or are they hanging out with me because they care about me? You want to get that core group of people. And then those are the people that you turn to. I think that, you know, I mean, thinking back to, you know, my teenage experiences, I mean, there were plenty of people that, you know, almost masochistically would go and you know, go to, like, the most popular girl in school and be like, well, what do you think of my outfit? Or what do you think of me? Or whatever. And then, of course, you know, they'd get smacked down and put in their place, and they'd feel bad about themselves. The trick is knowing who the right people are to ask. The right people to ask are not people that have an agenda of any sort. The right people are people who care about you and are care enough to give honest feedback, but are not going to give you feedback just to mess with your head.
Brilliant, Dory. Thank you so much. Here's a quick turnaround here. I notice in the last episode of the Dory Clark series on the Social Network Show, you mentioned when you were abroad the contrast between Americans in general and the humility, and I believe you said modesty, in other cultures, and how you needed to reframe rebranding or reinventing in that context. So in the light or the spirit of that, I wanted to put forth just a quick scenario here. I know that I was talking to, and it's just a shout out or an acknowledgement of Sasadi Nico, a strategist with logistics with us, and I was telling her about you. And of course, I was celebrating the genius of you, and I noticed that she was listening intently and getting excited about this new person that I was so impressed with and all that. But what was fascinating to me, her biggest reaction when I was describing you, the genius on the one hand, and then when I said about reinventing you, how you'd gotten laid off from a job, and that acted, mm-hmm. that acted as the catalyst for you, Dory Clark, with all due respect, the genius Dory Clark actually got laid off from a job, which is somewhat paradoxical in itself. but at the same time, what Sasadi was so impressed with was your humility in admitting that. And I'm also, I praise you for your humility. And I just want to toss this out there for all the people that are being bullied and everything. Nietzsche's dictum aphoristic quote, humility wears the toughest hide. Okay.
Mm.
Now, for those unfamiliar with that, I've tested this out through my lifetime. And I would just say this. I think that extremely damaging part about ourselves, like if pictures of someone are out on the net and they're trying to reinvent themselves, and you just pointed out brilliantly how difficult that is, sometimes just admitting honestly, like you did about being laid off, and this is the magic, the genius of Nietzsche, where he says, where's the toughest hide? When someone says, look, I did this, all of a sudden, theoretically speaking, their skin thickens. The arrows of judgment and all that, kind of, they don't penetrate. So I would just put that out as a quick genius level answer for the people who are trying to reinvent themselves. And then, of course, the rest of it is your book, Reinventing You by Dory Clark. Thank you.
Well, thanks. I think that's a really great point. And it reminds me of a woman. She's a senior researcher at Microsoft named Dana Boyd, who she actually has a new book It's just come out about, it's called It's Complicated, mm-hmm. and it's about the social lives online of teenagers. And Dana has been blogging since its earliest days. You know, she's in her 30s, and so since she was a teenager, she's been blogging. You know, they called it live journaling back then.
Mm.
And as you might imagine, you know, as a teenager, she wrote all kinds of revealing things, things that she probably thinks are really stupid now, whatever it is. But she has actually been quoted and made a point of saying that she refuses to take it down. You know, it probably would be better for her professionally if there wasn't this, you know, huge decades-long paper trail of, you know, all of her teenage crushes or what have you. But she said, no, I'm not going to take it down because it is my philosophy not to be embarrassed about things that I have written or done. If people want to understand who I am, they can, you know, they can check out other things. They can check out the totality of what I've done. But if you're going to pick out one thing that I wrote when I was, you know, 19 and make a big fuss about it, you're missing the point.
Oh, thank
yeah.
you.
Dana is great. We're currently trying to schedule her on the show, and she is a very, well, a lot like you in that, you know, she's just a very straightforward person and not at all head in the clouds type. Now, you mentioned a while back that you had graduated from Smith College, right?
Yes.
And last week we had attorney, doctor, Professor Marianne Franks, who was a Rhodes Scholar. And these things come together because this selection of Rhodes Scholars includes the first Smith College graduate to become a Rhodes Scholar. And she happens to live here in the Las Vegas metro area. So I just wanted to mention her. Her name is Clark Knight. She's from Henderson, which is next door to Las Vegas. And at Oxford, she plans to do the Master's of Philosophy in Geography and Environment. And majors in chemistry, has done research on potato diseases in Tasmania. Quite an interesting gal. And has written a book on women's contribution to architecture. So it's interesting how all these connections kind of came together at, almost 1 a.m. last night. So, or this morning. I mean.
Well, and I will say in conclusion, too, Amy Edmondson, Harvard professor who did the review on the back of Reinventing You by Dory Clark, is also headed onto the show in your honor, I might add.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, so we're so excited. We're so grateful about this series, and we're looking forward to the next episode.
Me too. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.